Flash of Time. This week in Washington, the political plot seethes and bubbles with antagonism and suspicion. All ties of party loyalty snap under the strain of vote-getting in an election year which finds America once more floundering in an economic depression.
This week's new issue of Life, the news magazine of pictures, out tomorrow, shows you the case history of Robert Simpson of Detroit, who fought through the long depression without government help, managing to keep one job or another, who this week, defeated by the 1938 depression, puts himself, his wife, and his three children on relief for the first time. Life shows you the quiet tragedy of this substantial middle-class family, become suddenly dependent on a weekly allowance of $6.59 for food. This family, whose five-room home is well-appointed, and whose children play with decent toys, though their poverty is now as real and hopeless as that in many a shack or tenement. And this week's issue of Life will show President Roosevelt faced with what may prove to be the greatest problem of his career, the Roosevelt Depression.
Life this week shows you David Lasser, soft-spoken organizer of 200,000 unemployed, who wants the president to put the jobless to work in government-owned and managed factories. Shows you Jim Farley, fighting to preserve wavering Roosevelt allies and wavering Roosevelt popularity throughout the U.S. Shows you James Roosevelt, unofficial assistant president of the U.S., who wants to be president himself someday, and who's getting hard experience in depression-time politics. Meanwhile, in the political tangle of alliances and alignment in Washington, the one magazine that reports pictorially each week the turbulent Washington news front is Life. And Life is eagerly read in Washington every day by old dealers and new dealers, Democrats and Republicans alike. About Life, says staunch Democrat John Nance Garner, Vice President of the United States.
I've been in politics for 40 years, and I must say I like to read Life because of the way it tells about the real political news.
And says Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts.
I look forward to Life every week for its magnificent and cleverly selected photographs. It is entertaining and instructive.
Each week, Life shows you the news of the world and the ways of its people. Be sure to get your copy of this week's issue of Life, the news magazine of pictures, tomorrow, Friday morning, early.
And so tonight, the editors of Life, the news magazine of pictures, present by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time. Vatican City, Rome.
Sorrowing for the innocent victims of the recent air bombardments of Barcelona, His Holiness Pope Pius XI has this day appealed to General Franco to desist from such bombings and moderate as much as possible the horrors of war.
I am touched by the paternal interest of the Holy Father, but we must continue to bomb cities and towns when military necessity leaves no alternative. That necessity is all the greater now that we begin the last chapter of the civil war in Spain. Francisco Franco, Generalissimo.
German firm of Krupp, bombers from Italy's Caproni, Italian armored trucks, German heavy artillery, a crushing juggernaut that blasts its way through every loyalist defense on toward the loyalist industrial center and seaport of Barcelona. And in Barcelona one night this week in a working class apartment house.
Just a moment. Who is it? Oh, senor, what do you want? Is it another air raid?
Are there any men here?
Just my son, senor.
Tell him to come out.
Yes, senor. Pedro.
Yes, mother? What is it?
Oh, senor.
Your name, age, occupation?
Pedro Malachi, senor. I am 16. I work in a boot factory.
Military service?
No, senor.
Why not?
I was below the age limit, senor.
You're not any longer. It has been lowered. There is a truck waiting down below. Report to it in 5 minutes with your belongings.
What?
Hurry.
Yes, senor.
But he is only a child.
We need the men, senora. Stand back, please.
Open up. Open up.
Front, the Franco offensive rolls across the Aragon plains to capture Bujaral, Caspe, and Alcanet. It reaches the Cinca River on the border of Catalonia. The Spanish U.S. Loyalist headquarters at Lerida, less than 100 miles from Barcelona.
Lieutenant, pack up all the papers you can. Burn the rest. We've got to evacuate these headquarters within an hour.
Yes, General.
Have the men blow up the dam on the Cinca River. Fire the munition depots. Explode the munition dumps. They will have to work quickly. Tell them to get out any way they can when they're finished.
General Porthos, word has just come through that 50 planes have arrived in Barcelona from France.
50 French planes? Wait a minute, Lieutenant. Hold that order. Major.
Yes, General.
Order the French planes up to the front lines at once. Strafe the enemy infantry as heavily as possible. That will slow up the advance. Give us time to reform our lines.
I am sorry, General. That isn't possible.
Not possible? Why not?
The planes are to be used for the defense of Barcelona only. They will protect the city from air raids, and that is all. Those are their orders from the French government.
Oh, I see. Lieutenant, carry out the orders I gave you. We're evacuating Lerida.
The army of Francisco Franco rolls along the road to Praga, past Daytona and Babastro. Lerida, key to the eastern coast, has been surrounded. From the hydroelectric plant near Praga, supplying light and power for all of Barcelona, Defense Minister Prieto talks to employees.
Is everyone here?
Everybody but the men we left to look after the dynamos, senor.
Good. Señores, I've come here to tell you that you must be prepared to leave this plant and get into the trenches on 24-hour notice.
Is the situation as bad as that, Señor Prieto?
Yes, I'm afraid it is. The rebels have entered Catalonia. They're still advancing.
Señor Prieto, I speak for all the men. I don't think we need 24-hour notice.
It is more important that you stay here. This plant supplies all the power for the factories in Barcelona. It must be kept going as long as possible. If we lose it, the factories will be shut down and every man in Barcelona will be in the trenches. If that happens, you will join them, because if we lose, that will be the last battle of the Civil War.
And as the great war machine of General Franco pauses just 40 miles from Barcelona, is held momentarily by desperate loyalist troops, reports the press of both the right and left in France.
55 motor trucks with 920 tons of supplies for the loyalists in Spain are on their way to Barcelona.
11 more French planes in Spain shot down 4 German and Italian bombers in fighting near Barcelona. No air raid.
38 freight carloads of munitions crossed the frontier into loyalist Spain last night in an effort to halt the Franco offensive. Left is opening.
But at week's end in Italy, announces Premier Benito Mussolini,
our volunteers in Spain must be victorious. Italy is ready for war by land, sea, and air. We can mobilize 9 million men overnight. And we have thousands of first-line fighting planes, which will be the most important factor in any future war. War from the air must be conducted to destroy enemy arrangements and weaken the morale of the people. People of Italy, we may sleep with peaceful dreams, for Italy is ready.
Time marches on. Washington, D.C. This week in the U.S. Senate, as debate on Franklin Roosevelt's Payne bill to reorganize the federal government draws to a close, to the floor rises Virginia Senator Harry F. Byrd.
Mr. President, all attempts to amend this reorganization bill have so far been defeated. Yet I am constrained to plead for one last change before this comes to a vote. Pass this frightful bill if you must, but strike out that section which would abolish the office of Comptroller General. If the United States Treasury ever needed a watchdog, it will need it if this bill passes.
Does the Senate ask for a vote on his amendment?
I do.
Call for the ayes and nays. In favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment is defeated. If there's no further debate, the clerk will call the roll for a vote on the president's bill as it stands.
Mr. President, as majority leader, I ask that the vote be passed over for today.
Without objection, the vote is passed over. The Senate is recessed.
As mystified senators gather up papers and drift toward corridors, New Deal floor leader Alvin Barkley strides up to the rostrum. leans forward to speak to Vice President John Nance Garner.
Well, it's in the bag, Jack. It's in the bag.
But what's the idea of letting the votes pass over, Alvin?
Well, why not take it easy? We've got the votes. Letters and telegrams are beginning to turn our way. We may even pick up some more support over the weekend.
Well, maybe it is best not to rush matters.
Yeah, I think so. Well, this is one weekend. I'm going to get some sleep. See you Monday, Jack.
But 2 days later, on Sunday morning, out over a nationwide network,
the reorganization bill sets up a dictatorship in the person of the president. Your basic liberties are at stake. If you value your personal independence, wire your senator at once. Have your telegrams on your senator's desk tomorrow. And stop Roosevelt reorganization as George Washington stopped George III.
Now, back into the news trumpets the long, soft-spoken voice of radio priest Charles Edward Coughlin. And promptly out over the wires of Postal Telegraph and Western Union,
Senator Robert Wagner, Washington, D.C. The undersigned strongly urge you to vote against the reorganization bill. Our individual...
Senator Royal S. Copeland, the president's bill must be defeated. Dictatorship...
Senator Arthur Vandenberg, hold your ground and count this as one more vote against the president's bill. People of the United States...
In New York City, by 9 o'clock Monday morning, Western Union and Postal Telegraph are running behind schedule in the biggest concentrated day's Washington traffic since Father Coughlin denounced the World Court 3 years ago. Second biggest day of comparable business in U.S. communications history. In Washington, as telegrams are carried by the bundle into the Senate office building, rumors fly along Capitol corridors. The ranks are splitting. That New Deal lukewarms are deserting the president. And shortly before noon, into the office of New York's New Deal Senator Robert Wagner strides floor leader Alvin Barkley.
Bob, you're still with us, aren't you?
Look at this stack of telegrams, Alvin. New York City alone. These are my constituents.
Now listen, Bob. You know this Coughlin reaction is no real barometer of public opinion. Never has been.
It's not only Coughlin listeners. There's 100,000 of these wires from all kinds of people. No, Alvin, I can't vote for this bill now. Wouldn't be honest.
Shortly after 12 noon in the chamber of the U.S. Senate.
The bill to reorganize the executive branch of the federal government has been called up for vote. Clerk will call the roll.
Adams.
No.
Andrews.
No.
Ashurst.
Aye.
Austin.
No.
90 senators are at their desks to answer the roll call. Largest quorum since the vote on the Supreme Court plan. In the jam-packed gallery, spectators fight for seats. Even Mrs. James Roosevelt has to sit on the stairs. On the floor, Leader Barkley shifts uneasily in his seat as he checks the aye votes on a piece of paper.
Vandenberg, no.
The clerk nears the end of the
Wagner,
roll.
No.
Walsh.
No.
Wheeler.
No.
The ayes number 49, the nays 42. The bill to reorganize the executive branch of the federal government is passed and sent to the House of Representatives.
This week, with the reorganization bill still facing the House of Representatives, with telegrams continuing to pour in, with charges of dictatorship hurled at Franklin Roosevelt by opposition forces, suddenly at 1 o'clock this morning, Franklin Roosevelt issues to news hawks a presidential statement.
The president has no inclination to be a dictator and feels that he lacks the necessary qualifications in any case. The charge has no relation to the reorganization bill and has been manufactured out of whole cloth by the opposition, just as the propaganda campaign of organized telegrams was devised for the benefit of partisan minority groups.
Time marches on. This week in Columbus, Ohio, in the execution chamber of Ohio State Penitentiary.
Everett Jones, you have been tried in accordance with the laws of the state of Ohio and found guilty of the crime of murder in the first degree and sentenced according to law to death in the electric chair. The law allows you a respite for your last words. Is there anything you want to say?
Yes, there is.
Very well.
It's all written down here.
You mean you want to read it here?
It's the story of my life. It's not very long.
Well, Go ahead.
To the people of Ohio, I am a product of your presence. When I was little more than a child, you locked me up...
When the people of Ohio locked up Everett Jones for the first time, he was only 13 years old. In the execution chamber of Ohio State Penitentiary, 20 spectators sit silent as Everett Jones tells how he stood before a judge in juvenile court 20 years ago.
Where's your family, Everett?
My mother, she's dead.
But your father's living. You have a home, haven't you?
I haven't seen my father in a month. I got a home, but there's nobody in it.
This is the third time you've been caught stealing. Why did you do it?
I was hungry.
I'd like to parole you in care of your family, Everett. But under the circumstances, I'm afraid there's nothing I can do except sentence you to a term in the state industrial school.
Everett Jones was 21 when he left the reform school. He tried to get a job. But Everett Jones had learned a great deal as the ward of the state of Ohio. He'd met Joe Rossi, serving his third term for burglary. He met Jim Collier, who showed him how to use a blackjack. By 1937, Everett Jones had spent 14 of his 32 years in the prisons of the state of Ohio. One night last fall, Everett Jones walked into a pool hall in Jeffersonville and held it up. When he ran out again, the proprietor was dead. This week in the execution chamber of Ohio State Penitentiary, Everett Jones finishes reading his strange testament.
There's a sickness among your people, Ohio. Your prisons can't cure it. Your electric chair can't cure it. Perhaps my crimes against society were a protest against the crimes society committed against me and against those like me when we were children. I have killed one of you. And I am deeply sorry. Now, you kill one of us. But it will give you no comfort, people of Ohio. It will not cure your sickness.
Is that all, Jones?
That's all.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
This week, Everett Jones dies for the murder of pool room proprietor Bob Lindsay, leaves behind him a document unique in U.S. criminology. But says Fayette County Sheriff W.H. Eisenhomer, one of the 20 spectators who heard Everett Jones' story and saw him die...
Sure, I felt sorry for him. But I couldn't help thinking when I saw him there in a chair how much nicer he looked than Bob Lindsay did, lying in a puddle of blood on the pool room floor in Jeffersonville.
Time marches on. This week, as it must to all men, death came to Edward Mandel House, 79. A shy, slight figure of a man, holding no office. But a generation ago, as the personal emissary of his great and good friend Woodrow Wilson, the intimate of statesmen, rulers, and the world's great, a moving figure in shaping destinies, casting shadows into this week of 1938 and beyond. It is Monday afternoon, the 1st of June in the year 1914. On the terrace of the Imperial Palace at Potsdam, Germany, a few court officials hover anxiously out of earshot. Colonel House walks up and down with His Imperial Majesty Kaiser Wilhelm II.
I have heard, Colonel House, that you are the power behind the throne in America.
I am President Wilson's personal friend, Your Majesty.
I see. And you have come to me...
No one knows better than you, sir, that Europe is divided into two armed camps, prepared and waiting for war. The President and I fear that a spark may set the world on fire.
Yes. The gravity of the present situation can scarcely be exaggerated.
And yet you, sir, have built the largest army in Europe.
Colonel House, that way to the east lies Russia, with an army of 1 million men. There to the west lies France, thirsting for revenge. That is why I have an army, Colonel House.
Your Majesty, the key to the peace of Europe is not in Russia or in France, but in England. If England, Germany, and the United States would stand together, we could maintain the peace of the world for a century.
Yes. Yes. If the Anglo-Saxon peoples stood together.
That has been the dream of the President and myself for 2 years. That is why I'm here.
It is possible. Possible. We have no serious differences with England.
It was with that hope that I came to Germany to win first the approval of Your Majesty.
Your Majesty, I beg pardon, but the special train...
Lady, wait. Go on, Colonel House.
I intend to go directly to England in the same informal manner. May I report to Your Majesty?
By all means, keep in touch with me, Colonel House. I do not know how you will be received in England. In the past 6 months, matters have gone far. Perhaps too far. But you may assure President Wilson that with all my heart, I desire the peace of the world.
This week of 1938 in Doorn, the Netherlands.
I have remembered my visit with Colonel House many times since 1914. I have often regretted that in those feverish days there was so little time. I talked with Colonel House for only half an hour, but that talk very nearly prevented the World War.
From the outbreak of the war, Edward House worked beside Woodrow Wilson through armed neutrality, preparedness, re-election, because he kept us out of war. Then war. 2 years later, on the evening of May 30th, 1919, in Paris, in the closing days of the peace conference in Colonel House's room at the Hotel Crillon, a meeting of the Big Four had just broken up. Colonel House turns to the Tiger of France, old Georges Clemenceau.
I wish, Monsieur Clemenceau, that it was a more generous treaty, more just.
It is a just treaty, Colonel House.
But it will destroy Germany.
Then let Germany be destroyed. France has been invaded too often. They are our enemies, monsieur. They are on their knees. And as long as I have the power to prevent it, they shall never rise again.
How long can you prevent it?
As long as France is strong and Germany is weak. And we shall keep her weak if we have to garrison a French regiment in every German town.
Very well. But I would prefer a different peace. A peace based on justice, not on force. Then if those who follow us make peace impossible, Monsieur Clemenceau, the responsibility would rest with them. As it is, the blame must be entirely ours.
This week of 1938, in Berlin...
Union with Austria is but the first step toward correction of the wrongs inflicted upon Germany by peace treaties. Who imagined the great German Reich would stop at the ridiculous frontiers drawn up by the Treaty of Versailles?
This week of 1938 in London, in a jam-packed House of Commons, His Majesty's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain is making his first statement on British foreign policy since the seizure of Austria by Adolf Hitler. Diplomats and members crowded into the galleries lean forward attentively.
Of the questions that continue to cause anxiety, the foremost concerns the relations of Czechoslovakia and Germany. We note with satisfaction the steps taken by Czechoslovakia to meet the reasonable demands of Germany.
Mr. Speaker, It is a mockery to speak of Germany's reasonable demands. Czechoslovakian independence is at stake. I ask the Prime Minister, will Britain back up France in case of German aggression against Czechoslovakia?
Gentlemen, we cannot plunge the Empire into war to defend any and everyone. We would fight for France and for Belgium, where our vital interests are at stake.
If you had dared stand up against the dictators of Spain in Austria, you would now have to defend Belgium and France. You've yielded to force. You've left us and the world in the same situation as in 1914.
I cannot admit the situation is as desperate as in 1914. However, it is true that by the events of the past 2 weeks, confidence and peace have been severely shaken.
Mr. Speaker, is there anything His Majesty's government will do?
Yes, gentlemen, there is. We can work earnestly in the hope of preserving peace. And at the same time, we shall do everything in our power to make this country strong enough to meet whatever call may be made upon us.
This week of 1938, the week that sees the death of Colonel Edward House, the week that marks the 21st anniversary of Woodrow Wilson's message to Congress that brought America into the war to end all wars, a one-time German corporal named Adolf Hitler by decree raises the standing German army to 1 million strong, greater by 100,000 men than the Imperial Army of Wilhelm Hohenzollern in the summer of 1914. Time, marches on. Much has been written in books, magazines, the movies, about the most famous penal colony in the world, Devil's Island in French Guiana. But Life's editors bring you this week the most amazing pictures ever made of this dread and famed penal colony. So graphic and startling are these pictures that it has been said their publication may abolish Devil's Island. In addition to 10 crayon drawings in full color made by a convict who later died of fever, Life publishes photographs of the actual escape of 7 tortured men crazed with thirst, and of René Belbenois, who lived through 38 days in an open boat, 1,000 days in dark, solitary confinement, 7 months among the Kuna Indians in the villages of Panama, and 9 fearful days as a stowaway bound for San Pedro, California.
Through this week's Life, the news magazine of pictures, 2 million families will feel the strain of political tension in Washington and the nation, will follow the men and events which are making history in Europe. And in this week's Life, 2 million families will watch a tornado hit the Mississippi Valley, will meet the real Snow White in flesh and blood, will see America's latest fashion craze, will go to a rumba party in Havana, and visit the most famous prep school in the world.
In Life, this week and every week, you can eyewitness the news of the world and the ways of its people. Be sure to get your copy of this week's issue of Life at your newsstand tomorrow morning, early. Time marches on.
Next Thursday night, the March of Time will be brought to you under the sponsorship of Servel Incorporated, makers of Servel, Electrolux, gas, and kerosene refrigerators. East of the Rocky Mountains, the time and stations will remain the same. Listeners west of the Rockies should consult their local newspapers for information regarding the new hour and stations for the March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company,